Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. Glad you could come by this morning. It's Friday. We all made it through another week. And it's also recap day here at Renee's Heart to Heart. So this week, we talked about squatters, especially here in South Florida. Talked about a couple deals where somebody actually stayed in mansions and did the upkeep on a home and things like that, and they had to fight to get them out of there. And there's even a man who's written a book about how you can squat all over town, if you'll excuse that pun, and live wherever you want to, as long as you can get away with it. I would say it's not a very calm way to live, but of course, apparently, some people can do anything, and they don't have the same kind of repercussions the rest of us have about doing something that they know they're going to get in trouble for. So apparently, it's something that has has happened a lot, especially here in South Florida. And Bullies to Buddy Day, which was all about social behavior and what we teach our kids about social behavior. And Wednesday we talked about the importance of a healthy gut. And yesterday we talked some more about hoarding. We've had a hoarding show before, but it is very interesting and very compelling what happens to some people when they feel alone and when they want to keep themselves in like a cocoon. They actually fill their space with stuff, and it actually gives them some sense of safety and love, apparently. So we're going to talk about all those things today. I'm going to bring Shelly in, and we'll start this morning's show talking about Monday's show, which was squatters. Good morning, Shell.
Good morning, Renee. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. The computer, I don't know if it's the computer or the internet or Blog Talk, was a little bit screwy again this morning. But I see posts every now and then. Okay. I think that they're always putting little things across on the banner, part of my dashboard, telling me that they're working on certain things. So I imagine it's getting bigger and bigger, you know, which kind of, if you think about the fact that it's really all over the world, Blog Talk Radio, the internet has done that for us. So I imagine there are some technical difficulties every now and then, but everything seems to be fine now. So I thought we'd start out, of course, recap day, talking about Monday's show, which was about squatting and people that actually, not the vandalisms and not the, we kind of differentiated that on Monday. We aren't talking about kids that just go in to tear up a house and use it to have parties in and other things that they know they'd get in trouble if they did in their own house. we're actually talking about people that are homeless and set up housekeeping in an abandoned home. And years ago, it was acceptable to start, you know, settle on a piece of land and work it, and it became yours. If you took care of it and maintained it and offered something to the community, then it could be your land. And those people were called squatters. And, of course, now it means something different, but the kind of squatting that I was really interested in is the ones where people actually move into a house that's been abandoned, obviously been abandoned, and maybe has already been broken into, and secure it and turn on power and actually start living there. And we found out there's a lot of stories out there about that.
Yeah. And the research that you did, Reen, did you see a lot of stories or even one story where somebody did that with a house that actually belonged to somebody that was just out of town, you know, like these people that live in one state for a few months and live somewhere else for most of the year. Did you find any squatters doing it to homes that weren't really abandoned but just unoccupied because they were used seasonally? Has anybody ever tried squatting in that situation?
Yes, I did. But they were stories that didn't give me didn't present a lot of credence because they were what if stories.
Supposed
stories.
I can't be like that wouldn't be able to do the what was it called? The legal term that they were trying to get? No, it just drew a blank on it. Something possession, I forgot the term.
And I don't have it written on these notes that I
It'll come to me in a minute. I don't think those type of squatters, if they were trying to go for that, would have been successful because, in fact, the house was not abandoned. And in most cases, they have people stopping by to check on the house periodically and that kind of thing. But I would imagine that without somebody knowing that, they could try to squat in one of those homes because a lot of times the electricity is left on.
Yeah, well, that's what they said in all the articles I read. A lot of times the people, like I said, we're talking about obvious abandonment. Now, if somebody is transient and they live up north for 3 months out of the year and then they live in Florida for 3 months out of the year and maybe they live abroad, for a few months and they travel all the time, maybe business, maybe lifestyle, whatever the case might be. Exactly. But those homes usually have security systems. Those homes usually have a caretaker where somebody comes and keeps an eye on the lawn, picks up the mail. I think most of the squatters from the stories that I read where they actually move all over, in particular South Florida, and just go into houses, clean them up, sweep up broken glass, do all that kind of stuff, and live there until somebody comes and tells them they can't live there.
Right.
And then the deal with the abandoned mansion, apparently somebody died or something there, and it was in probate,
like a probate.
Or something. Yes.
Yeah.
And but nobody was managing it, and that happens a lot. Banks, banks take a big slamming from us on this show because you and I don't have a whole lot of respect for most of them, which doesn't have anything to do with the people. It just has to do with the bureaucracy that's involved with the banking. So if you took in a whole bunch of houses, foreclosures on houses, and you're a big, say you're Bank of America or one of those really big banks, and there's purely and simply not enough people to keep an eye on all those different properties, and maybe one is lost in the mix. Those are the ones that are the most occupied because somebody will watch for a little while and realize that nobody's coming. I mean, if you drive around the acreage right now, you can see the ones where the banks are taking care of them. You can tell. They may even have a boarded up window. They may have some kind of vandalism on them, but you see that the lawn gets mowed all the time. You see that the mailbox is not full. And if you walk up onto the property, there's usually one of those giant doorknobs that goes over the regular doorknob that you have to have a key to open. And, of course, some of those homes are vandalized. And people are getting in and using the homes, but not, you know, like we said Monday, that's not the kind of occupancy I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people that don't have a roof over their heads and need to get out of the weather. I mean, last night, I dare say there were probably hundreds of houses in South Florida that are sitting empty and people were in them last night because of the weather.
Right.
Because where else are they going
to go? Today, my goodness.
I
think that there are people that are living out in that kind of weather. It almost makes you feel better to think that people are taking advantage of these
you know, of these abandoned buildings. So it's a real gray area, because on one hand, yeah, sure, it's illegal, especially for those who are doing it to a home that's truly still owned by somebody, which is very, very different than a home that's been completely abandoned. Maybe it's been foreclosed on. There is no private individual that owns it anymore. It's been taken over by the bank, and it's just sitting there, and it can sit there for years until the bank resolves what they're doing with it. And in the meantime, it's just deteriorating. You know, so mm-hmm. from a common sense standpoint, you look at it and you say, okay, we have this person over here, and they don't have a roof over their head, and it can, the weather in Florida can get really nasty, and they're moving in and they're cleaning it up, and they're at least maintaining the value of the home, you know, preventing it from rotting on its foundation, and yet at the same token, it's illegal. But it's, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, it's such a quandary mm-hmm. because...
Sure.
You can recognize it's not the right thing to do, but on the other hand, it's sort of solving a problem, you know, for both the individual and the upkeep of the home, because so many of these abandoned homes end up getting condemned. They just get so damaged with mold and mildew, and the type of mildew that can grow, not all mildew is deadly, but there are some types of mold and mildew that grow into the walls that can't be repaired. The wall would actually have to be completely removed. It can't be cleaned.
Right.
My sister right now is working for a restoration company that specializes in that, going into homes and businesses that have been damaged by fire, flood, that have mold spore issues, and they're working on an apartment right now down by the beach that was attacked by penicillin mold, and the woman who's
yep.
in there happens to be fatally allergic to penicillin mold. And you can't wash that. They're having to gut some of the walls to clean this, because you just don't wash it down.
Mm-hmm. Well, on one of our on one of our health shows, we're going to have to talk about mold and mildew, because indeed, mold and mildew for some people is deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And you're
mold
right.
Mold and mildew that's deadly for anybody, whether they're sensitive to mm-hmm. it or not. There are different
exactly.
strains of it. It would be good to do a show on that.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think too. And I think people will be, to say the least, surprised at how dangerous mold and mildew can be. Even if you don't think you smell it, you know, it can be deadly. Years ago, after Hurricane Andrew in the beginning of the 90s, I think Andrew was, and I was managing a hotel on Miami Beach, and it was oceanfront. And the days after Andrew, it kept raining, that ever-present end-of-summer drizzly rain that Florida is known for. And, of course, right on the beach, the moisture is already tremendous. So what was happening is everything that was damaged from Andrew just got, you know, exacerbated. I mean, it was terrible. Roofs were falling in weeks after the hurricane. And I'd walk in a room that I had walked in 2 weeks before that was fine. All I had to do was, you know, clean up mildew and stuff like that. By the time I got into them after 2 weeks, because there was so much procrastination in regard to monies due from insurance companies and adjusters and all the other things that go with a situation like that, you could hear the floor crunch, Shell, under the carpets. Crunch.
I know. I can't even imagine what that must have been like. Ugh.
It was awful. It was awful. And I had an insurance investigator with me, and was my job to show him through, and that's the time that I was given a check for $1 million and put it in my bra just so I could tell everybody I put $1 million check in my bra. But he said to me, "You got to quit coming in here." And I said, "Well, who's supposed to do it if I don't do it? I'm the only one, you know, the owners were gone after the hurricane because one of them lived on property and his apartment had to be totally remodeled." I said, "So I've got to be here and show all these people through." I mean, they kept me on payroll after the hotel was closed because that's all I did for months is the cleanup after the hurricane. So anyway, he says, "Yeah, but," he says, "women pick up the mold spores through their tear ducts. I said, what? He goes, yeah. He said, maybe you could put on a pair of goggles. I said, I thought breathing it in. He said, breathing it in is not good for you either. He said, but for some reason, women's tear ducts are very susceptible to the mold spores.
So now that I think I've heard you say that before, but it didn't stick with me. I find that fascinating.
And it'd be interesting now, all these years later. I didn't research it then. He told me it, and I took it at face value. I mean, what other reason would he have to tell me that other than to keep me safe? But it would be interesting to research that and find out if that's really a fact or if it was just something that this particular investigator thought was true. So I don't know. But
if you do get mold in there, I'm wondering what kind of symptoms it would cause.
Well,
you know, if it affects the body or if it affects themselves.
I think mold spores can be deadly to some of us, I think. I think that it all depends, like we've talked about so many times, about allergies and things like that and what some people can handle and what some people can't. I believe that to some people, mold spores can be deadly. So it is an issue. But again, this, you know, to keep this in line with the squatters, this is another source of protecting something that's already there and has some value and could be a home for somebody. So I agree with you. I think that it has, you know, it brings about mixed emotions and mixed points of view as to whether or not it should be something that is acceptable or shouldn't be. Obviously, you can't take something that doesn't belong to you. We know that that's stealing. I've always told my kids, you know, the old finders keepers, that kind of thing, and I say, that don't cut it with me, finders keepers. If you didn't buy it or it wasn't a gift to you, it's not yours. Don't take it.
Right. Right.
You know,
somebody's
it's
looking
pretty
for
simple.
It. If you
That's
if you
right.
lost your item of the same thing, you'd want somebody to say, hey, did somebody lose this, you know?
Exactly. So it's the same, obviously, with the house, but I also have the same kind of feelings that you do, that somebody needs it, nobody else is using it. It just, I don't know, it just follows for me. But I can also see just in the, you know, the sense of right and wrong, that it would be hard to manage. It would be hard to say, well, yeah, Shelley, you can stay there. Renee, you can't because you did it the wrong way and Shelley did it the right way. You know, can you see trying to manage a situation like that? It would be almost impossible.
Plus, the fact is that you get somebody in there in that set of circumstances, and then once the house situation is resolved and the bank is ready to resell it or something, you can't get the people out. So, you know, I mean, you see that with regular tenancies right now. People go in, you know, they go through credit checks, they get an apartment, then the guy or the woman loses their job. Now, all of a sudden, they stop paying their rent. The landlord tries to evict them, and it costs the landlord all kinds of money, and it takes them 6 months to get the people out. So this is a very, very common problem with tenancies and legitimate ones, reading a lease to somebody. So the banks probably look at that also. Okay, so if we allow these people to move in and live there while we're working it out, you know, just to maintain the place, what's going to happen when we need to get them out? Are we going to be able to get them out without having to get law enforcement and all that? So that there's so many other things that come into play when you consider working this. I think that it could be done. I think that an agency could be created that would be able to set up the procedures and protocols to make it work. But you can see just by those two facts, and there's a bunch of other things, you know, insurance if somebody gets injured on the property and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a
biggie.
It does
open up a whole can of worms of other things that can come up by allowing that situation to happen.
Exactly. So you can see the pros and cons, but it's a shame in the world that you and I live in and the things that we worry about and the things that we talk about on this show, that it seems like it is an issue that should be addressed.
Right
now, there. I think I mentioned the other day, this has come up on my computer several times just in the past 2 weeks. There's a company that's building these little, tiny, adorable, by the way, houses to help fight homelessness. They are, they put out the floor plan. You can see what they look like. And they're very, very small. They're smaller than a mobile home, but they're also built not long and narrow. They're built square or a little bit rectangular. But there's a small bathroom and shower stall. There's a kitchenette, and then there's a living area, and then there's a bedroom in them. And like I said, they're very small and very cute. They look like a dollhouse, like something you'd build in your backyard for your kids to play in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to keep warm, easy to keep cool, and doesn't take up a lot of land space. So, and more stable than like a mobile home, which, of course, we talked about the other day here in Florida. Mobile homes struggle because of hurricanes and because of the moisture and the humidity in the air, because a wooden floor in a mobile home often has, you know, its integrity is jeopardized a lot, the wooden floor. So these are on the ground. They, you know, they probably have a little crawl space beneath them for the plumbing, and they're adorable. But when you think about, that's more money to spend when there's all these other houses sitting empty.
Right, right.
That's what gets me, and I do appreciate and respect the fact that it would not be an easy thing to do. But to be honest with you, what is easy to do?
Right.
Go to bed at night, and then for some of us, that's not easy either. You know, I don't know. It just seems like there's not enough people addressing these kind of issues that every day, almost every minute, you see are getting worse in front of our eyes. So I don't know. I just think it's something that should be addressed at some point in time and something that should be evaluated. If you've got a house that somebody do you remember, the president, I think, was Jimmy Carter. I think Jimmy Carter had a lot to do with homes, Habitat homes or something like that. They called them HUD homes. You remember all that?
Yeah.
And that was kind of his deal. But he would build new homes.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I thought to myself, God, you got all these homes sitting empty. Why isn't somebody going in? Well, then I'd hear from contractors and stuff like that. Well, because you can't make sure that they're permittable. And by that I mean if an inspection is done, you can't be sure that whoever built it, especially if they were really old, whoever built it, passed, paid for permits, had them inspected, and had them passed. So then you don't know whether somebody can get insurance coverage on them or not, because you don't know if they have the right wallboard, or they have the right tacks up in the roof, or they have the right roofing stuff, especially after Andrew happened. This happened a lot. So I get all of that, but it still doesn't make sense to me to not utilize them somehow. Why couldn't it be refurbished a little bit and be used as a sleeping place for like a night like last night?
Right, but see, the issue with that is that somebody then has to oversee that, and there is no agency or department of the government or department within each bank or something that does that. And I think that it's something worthwhile for government officials or bank officials to say, hey, look, we have to create a department that's going to just do that. You know, and if these people are homeless with zero income, there should be a way of dealing with that. And if they're homeless but they have some income, because some homeless people do have some source of revenue, you know, maybe it's possible to have them pay some of the expenses or something, you know, but very, very reasonably and within the line of what they're getting, you know. There should be a way of addressing this and looking at it as a win-win situation. Even if you just got warm bodies in there keeping the house clean, that's a positive. Because I explained to you that probate case I was involved in recently, the one entity that was quitclaim deed the property, and the family members were fighting to get the property back,
the family members didn't have access to the house anymore, and the business that it was quit claim deed to, in quite an unethical way, by the way, but the company that was fighting to keep the house, they didn't want to give it back to the rightful heirs, didn't maintain it during all the litigation. And it lost over $100,000 in value in 15 months because they didn't secure the property. They turned the electricity off. So now there's mold in there. There were this kind of squatters that I was originally talking about. There were drug addicts going in there partying for days on end, and they would get high. They kicked holes in the walls in almost every room. Some of them were urinating in the corners of one of the rooms, so now the carpet can't even be saved. They just have to rip it out. But the house was actually in fairly good condition when all the litigation started, and now it's like the interior is completely destroyed. Like every room has some sort of damage in it, including mold, from them shutting – they shut the electricity off. Instead of maintaining it with nobody in there, so it was going to cost them $20 a month, just to keep something on, to keep the AC on, the lowest setting or whatever, to keep mold from building up. But because they made that decision, the bank that actually owns this is in Tennessee, so they're not even sensitive to what was happening to the property.
Well, that's what I'm talking about when I say the banks just are not equipped to have all this outside activity. But now, where else does this cycle us to? What else is one of our biggest problems, the thing that Obama gets slapped with every time he talks? What is our biggest problem in the United States today, aside from, you know, like drugs and crime and stuff like that? A social problem that we have, what?
Jobs.
Exactly. So you have all these jobs that need to be done, and there's no workforce to do them. So that doesn't make sense to me either. I mean, that's like, excuse me, I feel like I'm the only one who's looking. You know, sometimes when I hear these things or I watch some of these things on television, and I think to myself, what is everybody thinking? I mean, really? And then you have the people that just sit at a desk and just discuss all this stuff, and they're making enormous amounts of money, and nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing changes. It's depressing, to say the least. And it also shows me that, very sadly, we have difficulty seeing the forest for the trees, right?
Exactly, exactly.
So I think we get the squatter thing, and I'm going to continue to research, and when I find more information about that I think is of value to all of us, I will share it on one of the shows. Tuesday, Shell had an appointment and wasn't with me, so I did the Bullies to Buddies workbook on my own, and I think the essence of that day's show, the Bully Show, was about teaching our kids about social graces, social activities, how to be adjusted socially in any kind of circumstance, whether you're in a room of adults or whether you're in a room of peers or littler people or wherever you are, you should know how to handle yourself. And that's moms and dads' responsibility, to teach their children about the social graces. And in doing that, you make a child self-assured, comfortable in his own skin, and comfortable in any kind of surroundings. Also, you teach a child to be observant of somebody who may not have their best interest at heart, which is one of the most important things that I feel is missing. I think I told the story one time about my mom always telling me and my dad, never ride with strangers. They didn't do a lot of that in school when I was a kid. Do you remember them talking to you about, you know, not, you know, like now they do a lot of stuff like that in elementary school, talking to kids about going with strangers. Did they do that for Shelley?
Yeah, I remember there was like an assembly. I think once or twice a year they do an assembly, and they would talk about that. And one time they even had a police officer come. And I remember I was pretty young. I don't remember it happening every year. It only happened. when I was in the lower grades, like once I got into junior high, they didn't have that kind of stuff anymore. I guess they assume junior high kids just aren't going to go there. But it was mostly when I was in like fourth and fifth and sixth grade.
Mhm. So I don't remember them doing that with us at all. I mean, we talked about being respectful and things like that. I remember conversations like that in classes like that. But I don't remember anybody ever alerting us to the fact that everybody isn't your friend.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom did and my dad did, and they said, you know, you don't take rides with strangers. If you don't know them, mommy and daddy don't know them, or we haven't told you to go someplace with them, you don't get in the car with them. So the insurance man sees me at the local little store down the hill from where we lived and tells me, I'm going up to see your mom about the insurance. I'll give you a ride. And I said, no. And he said, Brini, it's all right. Your mommy and daddy know me. And I said, no. You know, and I get home, and there's the insurance man, and he said, I told you I was coming to see your mom, and I said, I know, and I looked at my mother, and I said, you told me I'm not to get in the car, and mom said, well, you do know the insurance man, and I said, yeah, and but I didn't feel like I knew him very well. You know, I remember thinking that to myself, well, I kind of know him, you know, but I don't really know him, and when he left, mom said, you did exactly the right thing. I didn't want to embarrass him or think that make him think that I don't trust him, because I probably right. do, but you did exactly what I told you to do. You don't get in the car with anybody, and you're right. You don't, you know, he's not a friend of the family. He's not this. He's not that. So,
plus the fact is that a lot of inappropriate behavior and even abductions happen with people that the child does know, you know, sometimes casually. Because there
that's
is
a very
that
valid point. Yeah,
it's kind
very
of
valid point.
They've kind of infused themselves into the situation, so now there's a little bit of trust there, and they do that on purpose to make everybody get this false sense of security that they're okay, and then something happens. You know, you hear those kind of stories a lot, you know, quite unfortunately.
Well, and of course, there's still all the controversy about JonBenet Ramsey. I'm sure everybody remembers that story about the little girl that was a model. And I think it was Christmas Eve, something happened to her, and they never really proved who did it, why they did it, nothing. For a very, very long time, the parents were the brunt of the accusations and everything. And I remember thinking to myself, maybe the parents did do it, you know, because they, you know, you'd hear all this stuff and you'd say, God, you know, why did they do that? Or why didn't they do this and everything? But after that was, you know, that was given to all of us to munch on for a while, and then time passed, and the mom ended up passing away from cancer, which she had been diagnosed with previously. All this other stuff happened, and I remember reading a story. It was in People magazine, I believe, and I got the magazine just so I could read about that story, because I thought, what did happen with that? Was there ever anybody that was, you know, a suspect, a real bona fide suspect, other than the mother and father, or the older brother who was just a kid himself and all this kind of stuff? There was never any actual accusations made to anybody.
I'm not so sure I agree with that, because I remember about a year ago I had seen a documentary, and I had there was somebody who was a suspect, and they were actually trying to build a case against this individual. I don't remember all the details, but I remember that part of new evidence that they either uncovered or took another look at and said, oh, wow, we missed this. I don't know if it was new evidence or something that got overlooked in the beginning that pretty much exonerated the parents, that kind of bolstered their story a little bit. And but I just don't remember who it pointed the finger at, but I remember this documentary was pointing the finger at a particular individual that had been looked at in the beginning, and then they found there was something wrong, like years later, they found there was something wrong with the alibi, that when they reached and there's somebody recanted the alibi, or I'd have to see if I can Google that and find it again, but I think something came up, but unfortunately it happened after she had died. So she didn't even know that there was, like, clear evidence to finally clear them. And I'm sure the stress of that whole thing kind of aggravated her cancer, because that's what happens to us.
Well, let me say this real quick, because I just Googled it real quick, and it is one of the top 10 unsolved crimes. John Walsh founded America's Most Wanted after police failed to nab the person who killed his son, Adam. But on December 16th, police revealed the killer's identity and officially closed the case. That's for John Walsh's son, Adam.
Right, right.
But it's been... this story was written in 2013, I guess, but 12 years have passed since December 26, 1996, when John Ramsey found, his six-year-old daughter in the basement and and found the ransom note for $118,000 for her safe return. And this past summer, prosecutors were finally able to conclude that John and Patsy Ramsey were not responsible for their daughter's murder, but that DNA points to an unexplained third party. John Ramsey still retains hope that evidence will track down his daughter's killer and finally rid his family of the stain that continues to make its mark. So everything you just said, it must be what that pertains to.
Right. So that they had this DNA, and they kept saying that there was another person in the house, and it couldn't have been from the older brother because there was not a familial match, so they knew it wasn't the son either. But they didn't have anybody that got tested, so it really was like almost like an intruder. They didn't have anybody that matched the DNA. That's, now that you just said that, now I remember that was the issue. So it exonerated them, but they have nobody to point the finger to.
So, again, that, I don't know how we snowballed into that from social things and being smart about when your child leaves your home.
Well, teaching kids not to get in cars
right.
with strangers. We kind of went that route. And
yeah. So I think, though, the biggest advantage you give to your child when you teach them how to behave out in the public is keeping them safe. I think that's one of the biggest advantages, because if your kid is street smart and knows if somebody is giving them too much attention, I think what they're teaching them now to do is scream as loud as they can, make as much noise as they can, or obviously just walk away if that choice is available to them. But again, if they are socially capable of judging what's going on in a scenario like that, say they're at predators come in all different sizes, shapes,
yep.
and forms.
Mm-hmm.
So and it could be somebody that you do know very well, like you just said. You know, it can be a family member, and a lot of times that is who it is. And somebody that your child feels safe with. But there's still little signs that if you talk to your child, something happened in my house this week. My daughter and her husband are separating, and he's struggling with it. And he came here the other day and took AJ with him without permission from anybody here. So I called him on the phone. I got his voicemail. I said, please, bring AJ back. You're ruining every kind of, every kind of thing that you've got going for you that will keep you in his life. He loves you. But doing something like this hurts him as well as it does everybody else here. Bring him home.
Right.
And try to take care of yourself, get yourself in a good place, and then go back to having regular visits with your son. This is ridiculous. You're going to get yourself in trouble, and he's not going to trust you the next time you want to take him someplace.
Right.
So he did.
Right.
He brought him home. And then yesterday I said to my 7-year-old grandson, I said, are you okay about everything that happened yesterday? And he goes, no. And I said, do you want to talk about it? And he goes, not yet. I said, okay. So then last night, we were by ourselves in the living room. Well, actually, him and Grandpa and I, and we were watching Funniest Home Videos. And he was sitting on my lap, and I said, you want to say anything about yesterday? And he said, I was scared. And I said, of what? And he said, well, he said, just of everything, you know. And I said, are you scared now? And he goes, no. I said, are you struggling with things that your dad may have said to you when he was alone with you? And he goes, yes. And I said, well, you have to understand that he's hurt. And, you know, people, all of us, when we're hurt, we say things that we shouldn't say, and things sometimes that don't have any real truth to them because we're hurt. I said, if if you're fighting with Austin and you come in and you tell me Austin's picking on me and Austin did this to me and Austin did that to me, and I say, what did you do first? And you have to sit there and think about it for a few minutes, and then pretty soon you look at me and say, yeah, I guess I didn't leave him alone when he told me to leave him alone. And I said, you know all those times that we've done that? And he goes, yes. And I said, that's kind of what's happening between your mom and dad. So don't, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with you and all this other kind of stuff. But he's pretty socially adept, my AJ, as everybody knows. I talk about this little boy all the time. But he, you know, I said to the kids when he was gone, I said, he's going to look at his father and say, Dad, this is wrong. You better take me home because everybody's going to be upset and then you're going to be in more trouble. And I said, did you tell your daddy that? And he goes, yeah, I did. I said, I knew you would. So it is about, you know, being aware of all the different things that can happen to a kid and not to scare them with it, but certainly to help them understand why people do some of the things that they do. Doesn't always have anything to do with you. It
right. And there's a way of doing that allows the child or helps the child work through it and still maintain their good feelings about another individual. I mean, obviously you didn't want to make him feel badly about his father. But it was good.
No, of course not.
But, right, so you put what his father is going through in a better perspective, you know, mm-hmm. but you allowed AJ at his seven-year-old years to deal with something that's really beyond his years. It's really an adult mm-hmm. issue, but you mm-hmm. handled it in a way that allowed him from a seven-year-old step to realize that, you know, adults aren't perfect. They can make mistakes, and it doesn't mean that they're a bad person. It just means they're going through something right now, and they're not at their best. And that's
exactly.
okay because they can get through it. And when children are taught that, when they're taught to be compassionate and to be reasonable about situations, and to adults that don't get blindsided by people's bad behavior because they sort of look at people, and including themselves, that, you know, that we're all as we can, and sometimes we hit bad spots. That doesn't mean we're a bad person. It just means that we have to work through something and come out the other side and hope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To realize that.
Yes. Yes. And that's the perfect way of looking at it. And I think that, again, this is your job, parents. It's your job to explain things to kids, not just giving them rules. You know, I always swore my father was good at that. You do what I say, not what I do. You do what I say, you don't question, because I always have your interest at heart, and you just do what I tell you to do. And I swore when I was old enough to have my own children that I wouldn't say that. I would explain, because it's not fair to just tell a kid, just do it because I said to, although there are occasions when you have to say something like that. But as a rule, they deserve an explanation. They really
right.
deserve an explanation when you make a decision that you know, affects them to any great degree. So, again, I think it's important for bullying. I think it's important for acceptance into a group of peers. I think all those things are important for your kid to be happy in school and to be safe, to be safe. So Wednesday we talked about gut health, and, of course, we've talked about this, touched on this on a couple different occasions, and we all know, I think, now and understand that our stomachs where our food goes, where a lot of our emotions go, where everything goes. It's imperative to have good health in your gut so that you can handle everything else that comes your way. And by doing, by making sure that you eat the right foods, disperse the right amount of what you've eaten, things like that are all important. You want to touch on some of the things that we talked about? You have
one of the things that you had asked me was, are there ways of slowing down the detox? And I'll get to that in a minute, mm-hmm. but just to kind of recap what we were talking about is that when we're talking about gut health, it really goes from the tongue all the way down to your intestinal mm-hmm. tract, or small mm-hmm. and large intestines and colon, all that. But digestion actually starts in your mouth. When you're chewing the food, to chew it slowly and more thoroughly is something very, very difficult to get for people to get used to doing, but actually digestion starts in your mouth. So if you're chomping on a piece of food 3 or 4 times and swallowing it whole, you're actually making it harder for the stomach to do what it's supposed to do, because you have enzymes in your saliva, and that's where digestion starts. So if you chew the food more thoroughly before you swallow it, you're actually aiding digestion because you've gotten some of these enzymes in the food. Then you swallow it, and now the stomach is going to break it down with the hydrochloric acid and now start getting it ready to go into the intestines. It's important to realize that you do not pull nutrients out of the food in the stomach. That goes into the intestinal tract to start doing the biochemical functions, fermenting and things like that, and then it starts pulling the nutrition there. What you can do through the stomach is increase blood sugar and things like that. So that's why medications are taken. If you're feeling really awful and you drink some water or you drink something that's sweet or something like that, sometimes you'll feel a little bit better because you can raise your blood sugar there. But the actual nutrients are going to be pulled out by the intestinal tract, the majority of the nutrients. So one thing about increasing hydrochloric acid in the stomach is eating a lot of green leafy vegetables. And the amount that it would take to correct that, the percentage of adults are low in HCI levels, the hydrochloric acid in the stomach, and that causes a whole host of illnesses by not being able to break down and digest food properly, including acid reflux. People think that if you have too low acid, that would alleviate it, and it's actually not true. A lot of acid reflux is caused because that you have the wrong balance of hydrochloric acid in your stomach. When you normalize it, the acid reflux would go away, providing that you also eat a little bit more smartly, because things like Nexium and a lot of these Tums and things like that are out there have, negative effects on the body. So you want to do it as naturally as possible. And one of the ways of getting a lot of green leafy vegetables in your diet sufficient enough to correct a too low HCI is to do green smoothies. And there's books out there by Victoria Bochenko. I can't remember the name of the book. I have a copy of it, and I must have loaned it to somebody. I couldn't find it. But it's by Victoria Bochenko. She's wonderful. I've actually met her in person. She and I have spoken before. And it's all about green smoothies, correcting this balance. They did a study with a lot of people that they helped correct different issues that they were having. And what they do is they take green leafy vegetables, kale, spinach, the darkest green leafy, kale and spinach are two of the best, and they mix it with fruits, apples, bananas, strawberries, things like that. So it has a nice flavor to it. You can even add a little bit of honey in there. It has a nice flavor to it. Very, very healthy way to start the day. And you can really juice a lot of green leafy, more than you could sit there and chew, and now you're replacing that. So that's one thing. So then as you go down further into the intestinal tract, you have to make sure you have enzymes and probiotics in your diet, because a lot of us are also deficient in them from eating a meat-based diet, eating too many cooked foods, eating too many processed foods, which rob our enzyme stores. So by taking probiotics and enzymes, digestive enzymes, will help the gut area to start breaking down the food properly. Now, when you do all this, when you start making changes, eating better, and it doesn't mean you have to become vegetarian. You and I believe in vegetarianism, but it's not the only healthy choice out there. If you start going to free-range meat products that are free from all the chemicals and factory-farmed animals, that's a much better choice. But you still want to introduce a lot more vegetables and fruits in your diet, a lot of them to be uncooked. All right, and as you start making these shifts in your diet, drinking water as opposed to soda, things like that, you're going to start detoxing. It's just what happens to us. And a lot of people will make dietary changes in their life, and then they stop because they start feeling like fluish. They start getting a headache.
Yep.
Maybe a sore throat. They might break out in full-blown. This is what happened to me the first time I ever detoxed. You break out in full-blown flu-like symptoms. I was sick for like 3 days. I was prepared for it. I had read a lot of books. I knew it was going to happen, so I didn't panic when it did. But if somebody hasn't really researched this and they're just trying to better their diet and they're like, oh, my God, I almost killed myself. I want to go back to the way I used to eat. They don't realize that their body is now purging all these toxins that are on the intestinal wall. And if you don't rid them from the body quickly, you start reabsorbing it. And this is one of the things that causes really, really violent detox, because in some cases the detox can actually be harmful to you if it happens too aggressively. So one of the ways of diminishing those symptoms, making it more comfortable and safer, because it's actually not safe to detox too aggressively, it can cause problems with the liver and the heart and things like that, is to, number one, if you do start feeling that the symptoms are too much for you to handle, you can have a little bit of cooked food, such as a steamed sweet potato or even white potato. You can take a white potato and boil it and drink that. It creates kind of like a foamy drink, and you can drink a little bit of that. It settles the stomach. It can reduce nausea. Another thing is red raspberry leaf tea. Now, it's leaf tea. I'm not talking about red raspberry like a sweetened drink. This is red raspberry leaf tea bags. And obviously organic would be the best. If you steep that for a good 5 to 6 minutes and then drink that, sip it slowly, that was something that at the Institute we used even for people that were on chemo, because it really helps to subdue nausea.
Settles your stomach and everything, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's another thing you can do. But one of the greatest ways of dealing with really, really harsh detox symptoms is to do colon cleansing, either through enemas that you would do to yourself or going through a colonic. The reason that's beneficial, and a colonic is actually better, and what a colonic is a way of irrigating the intestinal tract, but it's done by a colonic specialist. This would be done by a therapist you would go to see. And the water that is put in through the rectum into the intestinal tract is pressurized. And they can make it go very high into the intestinal tract, and then they, like, pull it out. And when they do that, the water loosens all the debris that's on the inside of the intestine and then pulls it back out. So a colonic is sort of like a Roto-Rooter, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
And it cleanses it. Now, to do that, you're ridding massive amounts of these toxins and debris and preventing the body from reabsorbing it. So you're not going to get it all, but it's going to reduce the detox symptoms greatly, okay? And it may take one or two or three colonics before you know it. It's safe to do enemas every day when you're doing the detox because there's no pressure behind them. It won't go as high, and it won't be as thorough as a colonic, but it's safer because there's no pressure. Certain people that have had certain types of surgeries, abdominal or intestinal surgeries, can't do colonics because either they're still healing or they have heart tissue or suture lines that might be injured by the pressure of a colonic. So in some cases, they can only do enemas because, like I said, an enema is really just gravity. You're going to insert the enema into yourself, allow the water to go up, hold it as long as you can, maybe massage your abdomen a little bit, and then allow your body to evacuate, and you're going to allow a lot of the toxins to flow out with the enema water. So although people look at that as being unpleasant, it's a very, very healthy thing to do. I do not recommend coffee enemas because they can really stimulate heart issues. So I do not, I mean, that's a big that's a big thing that's out there. It's safer to do like a wheatgrass juice enema because you also get some of that stimulant factor that helps the body to rid more, but it's also nutritional, so you're absorbing some nutrients at the same time. Because of my heart condition, I can't do coffee or wheatgrass. I can't do a wheatgrass enema either. It's too much of a stimulant for my heart. So also be aware that there are, you have different choices, and but that's a really great way to reduce a lot of the symptoms. And always educate yourself when you're trying something for the first time. You know, we live in the information age. Google it, read some of the things about it. But those are some of the great things. Eat a little bit of cooked food, like in a soup form, steamed vegetables, the red raspberry leaf tea, and then the colonics or enemas. And those are some of the easiest ways to slow down the detox and make it safer. The only other thing I'll say before we end this particular portion of it is that to push through a really, really aggressive detox is not really healthy. You do want to take steps to slow it down because you can harm your heart or your liver if it's too aggressive. Some people, you know, change their lifestyle and nothing. They don't even go through one day of detox. Some people, you know, like after 24 hours, they're in bed and they can't even function. So you have to listen to your body, and if it is too aggressive, it doesn't mean you stop detoxing. What it means is that you really, really need to detox. But instead of detoxing over 3 or 4 days, in your particular case, you may need to detox over maybe 10 days, slow it down, and let your body rid the toxins at a little bit more gradual level.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say real quick, all of Shelley's information is right on in regard to this. The only thing that she didn't mention, and I'm going to throw it in the mix, is that there are gravity colonic machines that are a little bit less aggressive and in some cases safer for you to use. So again, educate yourself on what kind of colonic and make sure that you go to a reputable person for this because it's an art. I've been to some who are awesome and I've been to some who just do it technically and don't provide any care for you. But we're just about out of time. I want to quickly say that the hoarding situation, please, if you know of something that's going on for a family near you or a relative or somebody that you care about, please see what you can do to get them some help. And this manager that we talked about yesterday in Deerfield actually took it upon himself. He called the television show that is called Hoarders, and he got their assistance. And there are people out there in our community that are prepared and will help somebody clean up their house to keep them safer physically, keep them safer mentally, and keep them in a much more sterile home than in a place where they can pick up all kinds of horrible infections and stuff. We also talked briefly about the fact that MRSA seems to be rampant these days because there's so many bugs out there that have mutated themselves to the point of no return. So keep an eye on people that you care about, especially the elderly. If you suspect that something like that's going on, I believe that you can call the health department as well. But this manager, like I said, called the TV show, and they are the ones that sent out people to help what was going on.
Right.
So I want to wish everybody a great, great weekend, and we will be back Monday. Next week, I've got another real estate person who is a specialist in kind of funky mortgages. If you got something going on and nobody says they can help you, I've invited a gentleman by the name of Lloyd. He's going to talk next Thursday about not just the short sales, but the reverse mortgages, the reverse mortgage purchases. There's all kinds of answers out there. You just have to have somebody who cares enough to search for them for you. So if you're in a position where you don't know what you're going to do, your house is flipped, in other words, you owe so much more than you're ever going to get for it, a lot of different things like that, there's other things that you can look into and other people that can help you. So stay tuned next week for Renee's Heart to Heart, and we're so glad you join us. Everybody go out there and have a great weekend. Thanks, Shell. I'm going to call you in a couple minutes.
Okay, wonderful. All right, have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Talk to you on Monday.
Bye-bye.